In alchemy,
hi Alden.
Hello.
In alchemy, the medieval study of the nature of base metals in an effort to turn them into gold or the elixir of life, Jung found the perfect metaphor for his individuation process. In the hero's journey or individuation, the foundation of Jung's psychoanalysis, the hero travels far and digs into the stuff and substance of his dreams and life to bring what is unconscious into the light. In this process, what seems like ordinary and base aspects of ourselves, or the self, turn into the gold of wholeness through the fire of emotions. This year's speaker, Alden Josey, received his PhD from Cornell University in organic chemistry, then worked professionally as a chemist for 30 years, doing what chemists do, studying how one substance or element, when mixed with another, reacts and transforms. Much like Jung, who received his medical degree from Zurich, University of Zurich, Alden Josey was fascinated with the science of the physical side of life. But also, much like Jung, who turned away from the safety of a prescribed path when he broke with his mentor Freud, Alden Josey, a Quaker all of his adult life, followed a strong leading to go to Zurich to become a Jungian analyst, from which he received his doctorate in 1989. He has been helping analysts turn the stuff and substance of their dreams and imagination to gold ever since. And as age has become more real to him, he has taken on a kind of hero's journey, envisioning how we can keep expanding our spirits and souls even as the physical self begins to decline. Our late decades, Alden has written, can become a profound process of simplification, of shedding, and of discovery, resulting in a genuine renaissance. Even as our physical self becomes more frail, at what Jung thought was at 40, the spirit can rise and soar, Alden writes. This weekend, we're going to learn about the descent into what the dreams and the archetypes can teach us. With Dr. Josey's help, we will do, as he suggests, turn and face conflicts we once ran from. If we can face the stuff and substance of these old fears, he explains, the result will be a blessing that resonates through the whole psyche, a state of grace and new balance. And with that gold of wholeness, of course, comes the elixir that will enrich the aging process for us all. Welcome, Alden. Oh, you do.
Thank you very much. I have to get turned on. Well, good evening to you all. I'm finally glad to see you all in one room, and me with you. I know you're tired today from having come from the places you've been to get here tonight. And I know we have 2 days and more ahead. So tonight is not going to be a marathon. But I can't say that about the rest of the time. I have to begin with a testimony of gratitude to the conference leadership for inviting me here and thereby bringing about the realization of an old dream. Once on a time, in my innocence of desire, or I don't know, perhaps in the desire of innocence, I thought, I'm a Quaker, I'm a Jungian analyst, why not dream about the FRCP? Which shows you that you better pay attention to your dreams and write them down, because good things can happen from those. So it was only then, when the invitation finally came to me, that I could actually contemplate standing here speaking to you and speaking about the life of the soul, especially in its relevance to late life. Of course, it didn't occur to me then that in order to speak about the years of elderhood, I needed to live into those years. I have done so. It reminds me of a very provocative ending to that book, Portnoy's Complaint. You know Portnoy's Complaint? Yes. Philip Roth's novel, published in 1969. It was really quite controversial because of its sexual themes. I loved it. After many pages of narrative with Portnoy visiting a psychoanalyst. The latter has the very last five words in the book. Portnoy's in the office speaking with his doctor. It's the last page. You can see the last sentence. And the last words go to the doctor. And the doctor looks at Portnoy and says, "So, now we can begin." So, in a parallel way, I think I can say to you that my early fantasy aspirations about standing in this place have come to pass. And so now I can also say to you, and we can say together, "So, now we can begin." We begin this weekend. I want to tell you a little bit about what is ahead. And I also want to tell you that I am not going to offer you this weekend a recipe for a comfortable aging process. I'm not going to invite you into the later years of your life as if it were going to be a kind of a bright, hazy, lovely summer day always, and everything was where you needed it to be, and you could relax. No, that's not my picture. I seem to remember somebody saying once about not coming to bring peace, but a sword. So what I'm going to say to you this weekend really comes out of my own experience of becoming an elderly man. And it's going to be in the nature of a challenge to all of you, but particularly to the oldest old who are here. I'll say what I mean by that in a minute. I am going to invite you all, but particularly the elders, to a new kind of life, in fact, a new life, that begins probably sometime in the 70s, on the average, and only accelerates after that, but it's going to cost you something. And we'll talk about that during the weekend. Let me just ask, how many people in the room are above 90? 90. One. How many are above 85? 1, 2. Is that all? How many are between 80 and 85? A few more. You see how the curve is developing? How many between 75 and 80? Yeah. And between 70 and 75? Wow, this is a group of youngsters here tonight. Okay. You can see perspective changes when you get on the other side of the fence. Well, we're going to find out that this can become really the most extraordinary time of life. But as I said, it's going to cost you something. And through the weekend, I'm going to try to see if I can tell you what that might be and where it might lead. So in the hours ahead, we're going to have four sessions counting tonight. I'm going to talk to you a little bit tonight about the general thoughts that I have about the aging process, now having come this far. I want to create for you a model of the psyche. We purport to be a Jungian organization, and I think we ought to have a common model of the psyche. So that's what's here. You can see that there's nothing on it yet, but that it will come. So I'll make that for you. And then at the end of the session tonight, on a chair by either door, you'll find a stack of pictures of one sheet, take one, which will show you the model in two dimensions. You've got a three-dimensional model up here. Well, anyway, I knew that tonight, straight away, I had to begin with a story. And this is that story. It's a tale of where I've been and how I got here. I hope that won't seem to be so self-reflective, but I thought it was germane to what we're going to do this weekend. So this is the story. It's a tale of where I've been and how I got here. It starts sometime probably in the year 1946 in a small southern Illinois town when a boy walked into his high school chemistry class. Lying on the teacher's benchtop desk was a small textbook entitled simply Organic Chemistry. The boy, well, yes, he was I, casually picked up the book and flipped through its pages. He was instantly and unexpectedly gathered into the book with its pages of mysteriously beautiful geometric molecular forms, its aura of the completely unsuspected and fascinating complexity of the natural world and its intricate construction, and the romance of endless manipulation and discovery of new substances. Here were the colors, the aromas, the tastes, and everything deliciously magical about the world were rolled up here in this small book. And in that moment, without any serious rational awareness of what had gripped me and my imagination, I and that boy resolved that that would be our life. And only years later, a lot of years later, did I realize that I sought this field of work primarily for aesthetic reasons and no others. This will show you the ascendancy of a non-rational way of responding to something over the rational way. So 4 years later, in the spring of 1951, the boy left the University of Illinois with a degree in chemistry and headed for Cornell University, a world away from Southern Illinois, to begin graduate studies. These years were wrapped around a 2-year stint in the Army at the height of the Korean War, concluded in 1957, when several things happened in smooth transition. But I have to tell you that while I was in the Army, I was posted down at the Army Chemical Center in Maryland, part of a small team that was trying to synthesize LSD for the CIA. I have a checkered career. We never did it. Too complicated a molecule for us then, for soldiers. So at Cornell, these things happened in smooth transition. I got back after 2 years in the Army. I was awarded, or that boy was awarded, the PhD degree. He pivoted into an about-face and headed back to the University of Illinois for a year of postdoctoral work before he stepped out, now no longer a boy, into the career world of work as a scientist. It wasn't hard to get a good job then, and the young scientist found one at the DuPont Company. There were some good years then, really good years. Years of promotions and raises, a deeper learning of the craft, the thrill of seeing his work published, and an invitation into research management ranks. But a cloud, no bigger than a young man's wisdom, had been forming on the horizon, and it could now no longer be neglected. I had begun to realize that should I continue on this path until my working days were over, it would mean the loss, yes, in fact, the death of something essential in my soul. So with some serious issues of inner peace and life direction, I went into a program of psychotherapy in which the good man who had been my therapist said, "I think you need to see a Jungian," and pointed me to a man who just returned from the Jung Institute in Zurich, who would become in time my analyst, then my friend and colleague. That was James Hollis, whom you may know. Jim thanks you for that sigh. It was not long in this container of interior search and discovery that it became clear to me, I must take this new path in the sense of one coming upon Robert Frost's two roads that diverged in a wood, and knowing now some 40 and more years after the mesmerizing discovery of organic chemistry that this new road would become, had to become, henceforth, the main highway of my life and the incubator of a new way of becoming myself. I said yes to the prospect of a renewed engagement with life without yet much more than a glimpse of what it would ask of me. And all along this way, it felt right. And that one sense became my compass. Well, not long after this, I entered the Jung Institute in Zurich in 1985 at the age of 55 and returned to the U.S. A newly minted Jungian analyst in 1990, my 60th year. So I began my private practice in Wilmington that year, and I've worked ever since, Deo gratias, continuously for 25 years. Now at 85, I can each day continue to begin in the way of Portnoy. And somehow, in the way of Ulysses, I'm going to tell you about Ulysses in a moment, and of Dante, of the Inferno fame, continued the endless work of shaping new eyes to see and new ears to hear, and learning what it means to become old. I laughed out loud when I remembered the newsletter I used to send regularly to my former colleagues at the DuPont Company, which I entitled, How to Get Jung After You Get Old. When I returned, I found that one of my colleagues had saved every one of those papers, and I had a full record of that time. Well, it has been a particular blessing, I think, to have studied and worked as a research scientist for half a life in the world of rational objectivity, close observation of the physical world, and of experimentation and analysis, before changing my mental and spiritual neighborhood to one nearer the subjective, symbolic world of mythopoetic imagination. I'll have a lot more to say about that and about these two kinds of shaping the world, constructing the world in the next sessions that we have, about the world of rational objectivity and the world of mythopoetic imagination. And let me just telegraph something. I think our culture is quite ill in respect to the balance of these two ways of being human, two ways of constructing the world, a serious illness in our civilization. I think I can see the symptoms of it every day in the newspapers. More about that later. I have no castles of the mind to defend, and I'm not a special partisan of either mode of thought, actually. I respect and see the beauty and the power of each, and that's why it felt like such a blessing to me to be able to spend a long period of time in each one. But now I think my work is pointed toward the goal of synthesis of these two ways of constructing the world. They're badly out of balance now in the West, Western culture, and they need some real attention.